welcome to Reading Your Way to Heaven. This is Jason.
What's up, Jason? How's it going, guys? This is Gabe. How you doing, man?
Good. I'm excited to talk about the Ocho.
The Capítulo Ocho.
All I could think of was ESPN Ocho from Dodgeball.
You know what's crazy about that? I was thinking the same thing. I was not.
Oh.
But what's funny about you saying the Ocho, like, ESPN is totally just like rolled with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like every once in a while you'll see something like on YouTube from ESPN.
Yeah.
And it's labeled the Ocho. And it's some, you know, off the wall, like little video about some kind of an obscure topic like chess boxing.
Well, they would also steal from segments from the movie. So I saw one time on Twitter they had the Ocho and they were doing the, I guess this has actually become a sport now where it's ping pong, but only using your head and like a volleyball.
I have not heard of that.
You'll have to look it up.
At all. I'll have to look that up. Yeah.
It's funny, but also impressive.
It's just so funny how they've rolled with that.
Well, you know, they're up to, what, three now? I use ESPN 3 because I'm a penny pincher and a stickler, whatever you want to call me, when it comes to spending money, especially for subscriptions, cable. Like, we don't have Netflix,
Miser.
We don't have Hulu, none of that. So we have an Apple TV in both my room, our bedroom, and in the living room. And people say, well, what do you guys watch? I'm like, well, A, we don't watch a lot of, you know, just television. But for sports, I'll usually flip on ESPN 3. And that's mm-hmm. free. And, you know, I'm able to watch a college game, football game here or there. But a lot of times you can watch it for free. And it's nice.
Yep. No, it's crazy. Just all the variations of channels that there are. And I think Dodgeball nailed it. And it's just so funny that they rolled with it. But yeah, speaking of the Ocho, as you so affectionately called it,
mm-hmm.
let's dig in here, man. I love how this chapter starts. Like it's such a funny line. A month of inactivity, a heavy meal, and an unknown world do not help a man to run.
Speaking of the Ocho, this is another reason why I was thinking of the movie Dodgeball. It was Rena's first part. I hear Cotton, the announcer, it's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see how it pays off for him. It's Ransom just running, full belly, tired legs.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Man, it's so funny. Just that like the obvious, you know, and the way it's just flatly said, you know, at the end of that paragraph. You know, again, I had to underline it because it's so funny. Like he's running through here and he's actually starting to get a little bit, you know, I don't know, I guess the edge is going off a little bit, the fear. And it says here, you know, nothing to fear except for the fact of wandering unprovisioned and alone in a forest of unknown vegetation, thousands or millions of miles beyond the reach of unknown or of knowledge of man. You know, there's nothing to fear except the fact that, you know, you're like wandering alone in a forest, you know, millions of miles away from home. You know, other than that, nothing to fear.
Yeah, you know,
it's kind of downplaying it. Kind of funny.
But it's interesting that he goes on to talk about how because of this event, it's kind of woken him back up to the understanding, the appreciation of his life. As he says later on, where he says the idea of suicide was now far from his mind, that he is now in survival mode, which again, I was happy to see. I'm like, yeah, okay, this is the Ransom that I know and love.
Oh yeah. 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 It's almost like he can't believe that he even thought that. I remember when he had his, what is it? The bellicose.
Yeah.
Mood. Yeah. Yeah. And he was kind of like, how could I have even thought that? Yeah, I know he's thinking of the task at hand. I liked the line in that same kind of section where he's talking about like his determination and he prayed and he felt his knife.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's from all those things that this strange confidence kind of starts to build up. But there we see it again. It's like it peaks out every once in a while, this idea that he is a man of a faith. To what extent, you know, I don't know exactly, but there's some kind of a background. There's some kind of a foundation, some kind of a, like, he knows or just feels like I need to be praying in this situation right here, right now. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of, obviously that's where a lot of the confidence can come from, you know?
So he goes for some hours, and I even kind of underlined and circled this, because again, for someone that ran for 30 minutes straight and just is still having adrenaline flowing through him, that he's gently going upwards up this hill for some hours. Now, there's a part in here, Gabe, I was hoping you could help me understand this better, because I wrote some question marks because I was not picturing this. So it's right in the middle of that where he's kind of describing what he's walking up. It's kind of in the second half of this paragraph where he says he noticed too that even the smallest hummocks of earth were of an unearthly shape, too narrow, too pointed at the top, and too small at the base. Okay, what the heck is he talking about there? Because I was having a hard time picturing it and understanding what C.S. Lewis is trying to say there.
Yeah, so again, we're talking about how he's meandering through this landscape and just going on constant. And it gets back to, you remember when he's first observing Malacandra, I guess the verticality of everything. And so you've got these like little chunks of like hills or I don't know, hummocks. That's kind of an odd word, huh?
Yeah.
The smallest hummocks. So I took that as like chunks, like a small hill or a small little section. But even that little bit of a hill was kind of an unearthly shape, because it was narrow and pointed at the top and small at the base, as opposed to maybe something that's a little bit more of a mound or of a gentle slope like a hill could be. So that's kind of what I was thinking.
Okay.
But I may be off base.
Your guess is as good as mine, because I mm-hmm. was – all I kept picturing was, okay, he's trying to get elevation, because as he says a little bit earlier was I don't know if there'll be Sorns up here, but I definitely know there's Sorns down there. And if they're down there, I don't want to go that direction. So I'm going to go the opposite way, which is up. So he's going up and up and up. And this is also where they're kind of describing, I think like you said, I think in the last chapter or right when they landed, about how because of the air, because of the atmosphere in this planet, I love, he's just, you know, it allows the leaves and the trees just to unbounded release them to reach for the heavens, which is really cool.
Yeah, no, it was cool the way that C.S. Lewis phrased that nature was set free to follow her skyward impulse on a super terrestrial scale. Yeah, just this he calls it perpendicularity, that the things are just soaring, you know, the waves, the hills, the trees, and even still he's just plowing through all of this, you know.
So I love where he is now also starting to guess, or he's trying to guess which planet he's on. He's like, is it Venus? Is it Mars? Is it the moon? And he starts kind of educated guessing, saying it's probably not Venus, because from his recollection that Venus would probably be too hot. He's like, well, it can't be the moon because I would see Earth then. But then he's like, wait a minute. There's parts of the moon that that are the dark side of the moon, right? The other side that never sees the Earth. So maybe we're on that side, or maybe we're somewhere else. It's exactly kind of what we were speaking about a few chapters ago.
Yeah. And his mind's racing, and he just keeps moving, and you know, I think it's one of those things where you don't really stop and take notice of the changes of the environment that you're in now, you know, Because he started, I guess, down at a much lower elevation, and who knows how many miles he's traveled by this point, right? And so you've got a different landscape now. He talks about these gullies with these streams that were warm. So there's some warmth coming from there. But of course, mm-hmm. because he's getting higher, it's colder and cooler. So as he gets closer to the water, it's warmer, and gets further away, it's colder. And so that's changing. And night starts to creep in. There starts to be a cold wind, and he's like, oh my gosh, how did this happen? And then all of a sudden too, his hunger and weariness smote him suddenly. Mm-hmm. like the way he phrased that
he got smoted.
Just, my gosh, exhaustion. You know, right. The guy has been moving constantly, he's hungry. He's tired. He's thirsty. And has no idea where he is or where he's going. And I think finally ends up ultimately deciding, you know what, I'm probably fine to stop for now, you know?
So right before that, I love this too, because this is something that I don't think anybody would take into consideration. Right before that, in the middle of that paragraph where he said he had not taken night into his calculations. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, like, you think about it, you're like,
oh yeah,
nice. Duh, but you're like, well yeah, if you're in a new planet, you never know, it may be day all the time or night all the time. You kind of don't take those things into consideration.
I mean, when you're trying to save yourself, you know, from certain doom, you know, and you're on a new planet thousands if not millions of miles away from home, yeah, you know, sometimes some things get by you, like night.
So I was kind of picturing this water that he's talking about as basically coming from like a volcano or like a geyser, you know, like what we have out in California and the West Coast with geysers. This is that warm water gushing out from the top of a hill or a mountain that's trickling down as it gets cooler and cooler. Am I on, like, is that what you thought too, Gabe, or something else?
Yeah, that makes sense. I didn't think that, but that's just because I didn't really think anything about it. I thought it was unusual for sure. Like, it's warm, it's effervescent, you know. But he's also on a strange planet, you know. So I think he, at some point, he mentions that it's warmed by, you know, the Earth or something underneath, and so a geyser would totally make sense. But yeah, no, I just thought that this was, I guess, I don't know, more of an opening of the warmth generated from the center of the planet.
Right.
And this is what's allowing it to come out. But no, geyser would be a reasonable,
thing. I was just, because he spent so much time near the end about that, of just how, as you're saying, it's subterranean, it's coming from under the surface of this planet. But obviously, if he's climbing higher in elevation and the water is getting warmer, then he's getting to the source. But he's also, as you said, it's getting cooler. So it has to come from underneath, as he was saying, and the only way
to
push up. But it would also make sense that it's effervescent, because then it's able to push itself up from underneath the Earth.
It's like warm LaCroix, huh? Delicious.
Delicious.
I mean, so imagine this. I mean, picture your ransom. You're in this completely strange setting. You're tired. You're exhausted. I'm sure you're so incredibly thirsty, right? He talks about that. And there's this water. You know there's water there, and you don't know if you can drink it. Like, man.
Right.
What a situation. It's enough to make someone, you know, have a Gollum moment.
Well, I was thinking of, I almost forgot too, if you hadn't pointed it out to me in the last chapter, of how he observed them not drinking the water, that I would have thought, dude, you're thirsty, take a gulp.
Yeah, yeah. And so you're right, in the last chapter, they have their own canteens, they have their own provisions. So he has no clue what he can eat, what he can drink. I mean, he said at the beginning of the chapter that suicide has passed him. So he doesn't want to intentionally harm himself, but at the same time, he's got to feed himself. He's got to get him some, you know, hydration. And so, what a precarious situation.
Well, okay. But the other thing too, is I guess we know it's not harmful to the skin because it says that, he would not drink it. Perhaps he would, you know, let tired basis. He sank on his knees and bathed his hands in the warm torrent. So it's like, okay, well, obviously it's not acid.
It's not like acid.
Yeah. So that's good. At least you got that going for you.
Exactly. It's safe to touch.
But right? The way I was thinking about it was, you know, if you were stranded on the ocean and you know that, okay, I can't drink the ocean. I can't drink the seawater because it's going to kill me with all the salt. But if you're stranded out there long enough, desperation kicks in and, you know, you hear stories of people trying to do everything in their power not to drink it, but eventually people do end up just out of desperation thinking or convincing themselves to drink it. So I'm wondering if that's going to happen to Ransom here, if he's going to get so desperate that he's like, all right, I'm willing to risk it. You know, if it kills me, it kills me. I'm either going to die of dehydration or possibly survive because I drink this weird liquid substance.
So he's getting a little delirious here, and he may end up getting to that point, but he has at least enough wits to stop and think, you know what, it's fine if I stop, like we mentioned earlier, because, you know, for all I know, I could be running back to them or, you know, into greater danger or into who knows what. So
yeah, I love that part. He's like, I'm going somewhere I don't know. I could be getting safer. I could be getting in worse danger. I don't know. Mm-hmm. All I know is present. And right now, looking around my setting, I'm not an immediate threat.
Like, I need to figure out how I'm going to get through this night.
Yeah.
And so, again, he's thinking there's warmth being generated from the water. If I find a water source, another gully, then I can camp out right next to it. And that might generate enough warmth to get me through the cold night, as it's getting a little bit chillier and the cold draft is coming through the umbrella trees forest thing. So there's at least, you know, a little bit of clarity, a little bit of a logic still remaining to help him in survival, I suppose. But then, yeah, he goes full Gollum at the end here, and he starts talking to himself, you know, we'll look after you, Ransom. We'll stick together, old man.
Well, even right before that, I was like, man, he's getting philosophical again. Like, he can't help himself. He's like, man, hugging myself. He's in the cradle position or the fetal position, just cradling his knees. And he's like, thinking about people back home on Earth and how they're getting ready to tuck in for the night. And I'm like, dude, why do you keep doing this? Oh man. But yeah, I love when he starts talking in third person about himself. But then I love the part where he's like, this warm water feels good. I wonder if this is also where those heinous monster snapping jaws also live, in the same warm water I put my hands in. Oh, I'm too tired to think about that right now.
Well, then he goes, you're right. It's not a safe place to spend the night. We'll just rest a bit till you feel better. Then we'll go on again. You know, like just rest for a little bit, but we'll keep moving. Cause you're right. That thing was horrible. Whatever that was. And there we go. That's the end of the Ocho.
That is the end. So, man, again, it's a very short chapter.
But
I would say this was a necessary chapter. Obviously, it's necessary to know what happened to Ransom once he went running into the unknown. But I liked it. I think it's just another stepping stone to what's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, I think we have a better sense of the unknown, and I feel like we're like Ransom, where at first everything is like a watercolor painting and everything is blurry, but things are starting to slowly come into vision, and we're slowly starting to get a better feel for the lay of the land and, you know, familiar with the trees and the water and kind of how everything is the perpendicularity of everything, and the unknown is starting to become known, and I think that's important in order for you know, more development and movement and eventually action, as he's defending for himself.
All right, so what I predict is, I still predict that he will eventually meet up with Divine and Weston. I'm still predicting that. But now that I know it's what I possibly predict.
You know, when I saw in this chapter, he said he saw like a little woodland creature or a little creature
red
scurry along.
Yeah.
I remembered your prediction that he would see some new species of life and see the little baby and then at some point see the big grown-up version of it. And so
I was hoping,
I'm like, okay, where's this gonna be? So that like, still might be out there.
It may
that
be.
Still might be out there.
I think what's gonna happen, this is a bold prediction, is he's gonna meet up with Weston and Divine, but through whether it's the Sorns or whatever the aliens or the natives of this planet, he's going to encounter them. He's going to freak out and go, oh my gosh. But then he's going to realize, oh no, these guys are actually my friends. And the way he's going to know that is he's also going to, they're going to bring Weston and Divine in some way, shape or form to be like, wait, I thought you guys were dead back there. And he's like, no, dummy, these are our friends. And, you know, we've whatever, I can't think right now, I can't use the words, they're not coming, you know, we've befriended them in the past and blah, blah, and then they go on to explain who they are.
That is a bold prediction,
so going out there, I'm going out on that big leafy branch in Melicandre, reaching.
I think the thing that makes it so bold for me is that Weston and Divine have no idea why they want another human person, and they think it's for sacrifice. You know, they think that the Sorns or whoever, whatever, want a human, to be able to dispose of, to pay the toll. Okay, if you guys are going to be here on the planet, you need to give us one of you guys as payment. That's your fee. So. With that in mind, having a fuzzy reunion of sorts where we're all friends. Oh, don't you realize we were actually all friends in the end? It's a bold prediction, Jason.
Well, maybe not like warm and fuzzy, but I think they'll reunite because
reunited.
We know that Weston holds the cards close to his vest. He does not tell us anything. Mm-hmm. And so I would not be shocked if Weston comes back and says, here's why we did what we did, because I couldn't tell you ahead before. So there's maybe a missing puzzle piece. So I wouldn't be shocked if that was the case, but I also, like you said, I wouldn't be shocked if they try to reunite them. And so the natives are like, well, let's bring out Weston and Divine because they're the same species. And obviously they brought him here, so they may know each other. Since they know each other, he may listen to them. And Ransom maybe, you know, hopefully would be definitely suspicious of like, whoa, wait a minute. How did you guys survive? B, is this a trick? Are you guys trying to pull a fast one on me? What's going on? So you're right. Like, I don't see it being like, oh, thank God, and hugging each other. But I definitely would see. I definitely see them coming back to each other.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Are you still holding on to the theory? I think you threw out several weeks ago the possibility that Weston actually is not from Earth, that he is maybe a native of Melicandre, an undercover agent of sorts.
I think that is, I think that's becoming less and less likely. I really need to write these predictions down so I don't forget them. So I'm glad you remembered. Because I do, like, now that you brought it up, I remember now that I said that. I think that's less and less likely now. But again,
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised. And I don't want to let go of that just yet. Because, and I watch right when I'd be like, oh, yeah, no, he's totally an earthling. He's a human being. The next chapter, bam! Found out, no, he's from Melaconda. But I think
Dun
he,
dun dun.
I don't, more and more, I'm thinking he's like one of the first people to find Melaconda, and so
He's
he's
either an
the
alien, which would
explorer.
explain his poor people skills and lack of communication, or
Right.
he's just a jerk. You know, there's that too. He could just be a rude human, you know?
Yeah, there's plenty of them out there.
Yeah, yep. This is
Yeah,
true.
but I think he was, maybe he's like the first contact of, Melaconda, and so he's, that's why he's changed. I'd be curious. I mean, I'd be really curious. I hope, I don't know, but I would hope to get some type of backstory on Weston. And to hear more about his backstory, where he's from, and why he is the way that he is.
Why are you the way that you are?
I think that's it. I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else?
No, man, I think that's about it. Yeah,
All right.
tune in next week. Let's see what happens on chapter 9 of Out of the Silent Planet.
Nueve.
Until next time,
I
this is Gabe, and I love you. Bye.
just gonna let this hang. I'm not gonna stop it yet. I'm just gonna let it hang here. Just let it build. All right. Love you, bye.